Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
There has never been any doubt that addiction has an effect on health. People who are truly hooked will choose their drug over food, sleep, financial security, even physical safety, and that takes a toll on the body. But the source of the problem is actually the brain. And it turns out addicts' brains are shaped by their habits to make it easier to keep using than to quit. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rita Z. Goldstein is chief of the Neuropsychoimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions Research Program, or NARC, at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Her lab has used special equipment to peer inside the brains of people who feel compelled to feed their addictions and found changes not only to their reward sensitivity, but to the system that helps healthy people resist temptations and make good decisions. Her work is featured in the article How Science is Unlocking the Secrets of Addiction in the September issue of National Geographic. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Rita, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We sometimes think of addicts as people who lack self-control, but it sounds like using addictive substances can change our brains so that we lose control.
Yes. So in our IRESA model of addiction, we emphasize that impairments in response inhibition and salience attribution are core to our ability to understand the core symptoms and the clinical symptoms of addiction that have to do with drug self-reinforcement, craving, binging, and withdrawal that is so severe as to lead the person back to drug self-administration despite the best intentions not to use it. And we emphasize that the integrity of the prefrontal cortex of our brain is essential to understanding drug addiction, expanding the usual view beyond the reward circuits, and emphasizing that addiction is way beyond just bad habits, drug abuse, or even drug dependence, because only in addiction you have this constellation where there is a continued compulsive drug use despite a decrease in the reward that is derived from the drug, and despite very catastrophic consequences to the individual and their life. So only in drug addiction you can see that type of continued compulsive use despite very, very important things that can basically wait, but the need for using the drug cannot.
So drugs effectively teach the brain how to be addicted.
You can say that in some ways. Yes, definitely there is a direct effect of drugs, but there is also some predisposing vulnerabilities. So people are very different. There is a genetic makeup that is very different between people. There is also prenatal type of influences, and there are interactions with environment. And the environment is the exposure to the drugs.
When you scan the brain of a person with an addiction, what are the most notable differences, the things that jump out at you from that brain to a neurotypical brain?
So the first thing to make an emphasis on is actually that we compare groups of individuals. So it's not that we're not yet where we want to be, which is precision medicine and really to learn about any one person. But in our studies, we'll actually compare people with crack cocaine addiction, so groups of people who are addicted to crack cocaine versus groups of people who are not. And if you look at those groups, definitely there are some striking differences. One is the decrease in the gray matter, in the neuronal type volume and integrity of the brain regions, such as the prefrontal cortex, that is essential to our ability to make advantageous decisions, to make the right type of judgment calls at the right moment, the ability to inhibit behavior, to self-control, to regulate emotion. So we have decreases in those brain regions, and they are related to those type of behaviors that we can measure with different tasks that are not even related to drug addiction. And lab type of neuropsychological tasks that are a model of what happens outside the lab when there is an actual decision between taking a drug right now or passing through a place where it reminds of a drug and then there is an increase in craving. So those type of decreases in the gray matter in those brain regions underlie this type of disadvantageous decisions and the catastrophic consequences that ensue.
So tell us, Rita, about the kind of cognitive tests that you give to people that you are, whose brains you are studying for signs of addiction. What do you ask them to do?
We use numerous different tasks. They're called neuropsychological tests, and they can be paper and pencil or computerized tasks of attention and memory, learning, decision making, and self-awareness. Some of the tasks are standard in the field, and people can get them administered under different type of contexts in the neuropsychological type of office. And some tasks we design specifically for our subjects, for our individuals. And basically, every different task that we use, we think about it. How can it enhance our understanding of addiction? How can we tweak it a little better so that we can really look at the core of what's going on with addiction, that reduce self-control, especially in a very salient drug-related context?
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, when you say a salient drug-related context, you sometimes will expose your subjects to drug cues and then see how they perform on these tasks.
Exactly. So in one task, people just passively look at pictures that can be cocaine or drug-related, as compared to looking at pictures of very pleasant stimuli such as babies, pets, and as compared to very unpleasant images, such as a gun pointed at you, or just neutral images. And those type of direct comparisons, when a person is just looking at a picture to another picture, teaches us a lot about the brain and how it reacts to those type of drug-related cues when we compare it, that essential comparison between a drug-related cue to something else that is very, very salient, very pleasant even, such as a baby's face.
So I have not used cocaine. So if I saw, you know, an image of that, I don't know that it would do anything to my brain. But what if I were someone who had used it but wasn't addicted? Would my brain respond in a similar way to an addict because I know what it's like to feel that high?
So actually, we did perform these studies, and in these type of studies, we look at EEG, electroencephalography, and the event-related potentials. So these are potentials that are part of the EEG signal, and it is positive or negative deflections in the EEG signal that is time-locked to a certain event, which are those pictures. And when we compare people who are healthy individuals, not using cocaine, crack cocaine, not addicted, to people who are addicted to cocaine, the first thing that jumps actually from our images is that when we analyze an event-related potential that's called the late positive potential, it's a marker of salient targets. When we compare that marker, when groups of people with cocaine addiction look at those cocaine type of images as compared to neutral images, there is an activation. We can see very clearly that there is a salience attributed to those type of images. And that type of a salient marker we see in healthy controls when they are looking at pleasant and unpleasant images. So there is a value in both of those types of images, whether pleasant or unpleasant. The healthy individuals do not show that salient type of marker when they are looking at the cocaine-related images. And the cocaine-addicted individuals do show it. And they also show a decrease in that salience attribution, a habituation, a premature habituation when they're looking at pleasant and unpleasant images. So as if that salience that is now kind of usurped by the cocaine images and depleting the resources available when you are processing something that is very, very salient to everybody and to the addicted individuals too. There is just this decrease in the ability to sustain that type of salience regulation.
Okay, so if I have this right, and I'm going to be guessing on the images here, but if you showed a regular person who had no addiction, a picture of a piece of chocolate cake and something that suggests a beach vacation and some cocaine, they would probably focus on the beach vacation and the chocolate cake. A person who is addicted can really hardly even see those other two things. They're going to focus on the cocaine.
It's not that they cannot hardly see it. It's that immediate response, the salience response is there, but it just habituates prematurely when people passively look at those images. So it as if the brain is kind of, there is that type of sluggishness that is not there when people with addiction look at cocaine-related images. So the salience keeps on going for the cocaine-related images, but not the other ones. And we also designed a task where we ask people to choose, not only to passively look at those images, but also to choose what it is they're looking at. So you can choose to look at this type of cocaine image, or you can choose to look at that piece of chocolate cake that you mentioned. And there is a clear difference in the choice behavior of people with addiction. So they have more choices towards the drug-related images. They would choose to look at the drug-related images more than the healthy control subjects who choose to look at pleasant type of images more often. And this type of choice on a lab task, just choose what it is you want to look at, correlates with people's current drug use outside the lab, their use in the last 30 days. But when we measured it at baseline, it also prospectively predicts substance use 6 months later. So what you choose to look at right now actually predicts your relapse if you are a cocaine-addicted individual.
But you also discovered that when people stop using cocaine, their brains can heal, they can regain some of that lost volume in the prefrontal cortex.
Absolutely. It's a series of studies where we looked at baseline, so people who just finished treatment as usual a few weeks after that, and then we follow them up for 6 months when they're abstinent or where their drug use is substantially reduced. And we can see recovery in the gray matter, in the prefrontal cortex, that brain region that is so essential to our advantageous decision-making and to this type of salience attribution. And so we saw that enhanced gray matter, so actually recovery of those type of brain regions 6 months later, and it's associated with recovery in decision-making, in the ability to wait and to think about longer-term consequences. It was also associated with the recovery of that salience attribution. So suddenly, there is a more salience that's attributed to the pleasant images than to the drug-related cues.
Does that mean it gets easier over time after someone has quit an addictive substance to say no to that substance?
Basically, this study suggested that the people who were able to abstain for 6 months, yes, their brain regions would heal, would basically change in a way that will help them maintain saying no or reduce their drug use. But this is a selected subsample of individuals. Those people were able to maintain abstinence for 6 months. Maintaining abstinence, if you're an addicted individual, is the hardest thing one can ever do. And relapse rates are staggering across drugs of abuse. So what we have to do is think about ways to help the brain say no, to help the brain regulate emotion and control behavior, but starting very, very, very early on in this process. So definitely not wait 6 months, because drug addiction is a lethal disorder. People die from it, and actually a staggering numbers of people die from it. It's the leading cause of death for people under 50, which is an amazing statistic to think about. So if we can intervene very early on when a person is just trying to abstain, when they're treatment seeking, with many, many different ways, maybe we can help the brain go through that pathway towards recovery.
My guest is Rita Z. Goldstein. She is chief of the Neuropsychoimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions Research Program at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Her work is featured in the article How Science is Unlocking the Secrets of Addiction in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rita Z. Goldstein. At the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, she is chief of Neuroimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions Research Program, also known as NARC. You can read about her work in the September issue of National Geographic in a piece called How Science is Unlocking the Secrets of Addiction. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Rita, your focus for this, you said, is crack cocaine, understood to be physically addictive, as is alcohol, as is heroin. There are some drugs that are physically addictive. How does that, is the brain responding in a different way to drugs that also have a component that causes the body to be addicted in addition to the brain?
So all drugs that are abused by humans, all of them, including nicotine, including alcohol, crack cocaine, heroin, all of them have direct effects on all systems of on the brain. And I'm going to be focusing on the brain because that's my area of study. And all of them cause a type of dopamine response. Mm-hmm. So this is a neurotransmitter in the brain, a chemical that cells need to communicate with each other. And there are many, many different types of neurotransmitters, but dopamine is an essential one to tag stimuli as salient. It actually has a huge role in all different functions of learning, of memory, of reward processing, and novelty detection, the ability to also recognize aversive events. And there is a huge type of dopamine release and dopamine response that are caused by all drugs of abuse in different mechanisms. So some of them are causing it directly, some of them are causing it indirectly. But when compared to other type of salient stimuli or reinforcers, primary reinforcers that we need to survive, that we're born knowing we need them, for example, food, when you compare drugs of abuse to something like food, there is a hyperphysiological response to drugs of abuse in terms of dopamine release. And this is an acute type of response. So at first type of drug intake, you have this hyperphysiological dopamine response. But then as addiction progresses, as chronic drug use continues, there is decreases in this type of response. And long-term, you have actually the opposite reaction. You have a decrease in the brain's ability to respond to dopamine. Basically, you have a decrease in dopamine receptor availability. And that may underlie the type of anhedonia that is experienced by drug-addicted individuals. So people think about addiction as a disorder of a high, but actually it has to be thought of as a disorder of a low in many ways, because the drug use continues despite a decrease in the pleasure that is derived from the drug and from other stimuli in the environment. So you have a hypodopaminergic state, not a hyper state.
I ask this question with no disrespect to your study subjects who are contributing to important research, but what are the challenges of working with people who are actively addicted to crack cocaine during the period that you're studying them?
So our subjects are wonderful, and people with addiction, I have a problem with calling a person an addict. I call people individuals with addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think that represents better what's really going on, where we have more than 20 million of individuals addicted in the U.S. alone. One of the challenges in terms of imaging studies is that people's lives who are experiencing acute episodes of addiction are very chaotic and very unpredictable. And also there is a lot of type of withdrawal symptoms, and you have the day after type of, after binging, for example. So sometimes keeping appointments on time is a challenge. And especially for studies where we require a certain timely type of appearance, or studies where we need to scan individuals several times, not just one time, but let's say after a day of abstinence or after another week or then another few weeks. So we follow up people longitudinally. And that sometimes is a challenge, especially early on in abstinence process. So we can recruit people who have been long-term abstinent, and that's actually has been no problem for us. And then we can study people in treatment after the treatment facility actually lets them leave the facility. But people immediately, when they leave those facilities, that's a high vulnerability time for them.
Are there particular ages at which people are especially vulnerable to becoming addicted?
Well, I think adolescence is considered a very turbulent time, and that is when also you have the most a lot of development in the prefrontal cortex that coincides with very risky behaviors that are actually normative for that age. And for vulnerable individuals, that type of interaction can be very dangerous later on. There are also peaks of developing addiction later on, but I think the adolescent time is considered the time where the window for the past toward substance use and addiction starts and reaches a certain peak.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. First up, Scott is calling from Irving. Hi, Scott.
Hey, a quick question. I kind of have OCD tendencies. I know this show is about addiction, but my question is, do people with addictions, not OCD, do people with addictions, is their brain, are they born with a brain that is prone to that, or do they get addicted because of certain bad decisions that they make?
So basically, it's an interaction. Some people, for example, there are some factors that predispose some people towards addiction and protect others against developing addiction. So people who are born to mothers who have smoked cigarettes, for example, during pregnancy, they are, as a group, they're born with a thinner orbitofrontal cortex, and having that thinner orbitofrontal cortex predisposes them towards more drug experimentation when they are adolescents. So that's a clearly vulnerable population. And for those, there is a higher risk that they will become addicted. There is also behavioral type of traits that we don't fully yet understand. They may be also genetically influenced. So for example, impulsivity. Being more impulsive predisposes individuals towards substance use and then addiction. And compulsion is definitely part of being addicted. So when a person is already addicted, that type of compulsive, habitual drug use is definitely part of the drug addiction phenomenology.
I know that we've been talking about your research into people who have used crack cocaine, but I wonder, is there a difference from the perspective of brain imaging between addictive substances like cocaine or alcohol and addictive behaviors, things like gambling and shopping that some people develop a problem with? Does the brain register these things in similar ways?
We're just in the beginning of looking at this. There are many, many similarities and many differences, and we still have to look at the differences. There are similarities across all types of addiction, including behavioral addictions, such as, for example, obesity, the ones that underlie obesity in some people, that and is a non-drug type of addiction, where it is associated with the same type of reduced dopamine receptor availability I mentioned before, that that is characterized throughout all drugs of addiction, in all people with in groups of people with drug addiction, and it has also been shown in people with obesity. In terms of gambling and other type of behavioral addictions, there are impairments in the prefrontal cortex ability to underlie that type of self-control that I mentioned. But still, it's such a complex study. And in order to be able to compare groups, this is exactly what we have to do. But in outside of the lab, there is a lot of comorbidity, and that complicates our type of studies. So people with crack cocaine addiction, many of them also drink alcohol. Many of them also smoke some pot, basically. Some of them can gamble. Although with the gambling, many people who gamble drink alcohol, and some do not at all. So those type of studies where we start to actually compare these different groups of people are essential, and we're not there yet. We definitely should do these type of studies. I'm talking about imaging studies.
Right. What happens with your subjects when you show them what's going on in their brains when they're exposed to these particular cues? Does it affect their relationship to their addiction?
I think what has been really very pronounced reaction is that when people look at the images where we see recovery of the gray matter. So not when we show them the pictures in the lab when we study it and those enhanced salience to the drug use, I think people expect that. They know that their brain is being hijacked. They live through that. For them, it's not a vague conceptual concept. But when we show them the recovery of gray matter in those very essential brain regions, I think that is something that has a huge impact on people's hope, actually.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Mark is calling now from Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris. So you touched on my fundamental question, which was, what is the definition of a drug that you're using? And I guess if I heard properly, it was something that causes a release of dopamine and, you know, sort of makes people want to seek that pleasure again. And you could broaden that to behavior as well. But then, so now my next question becomes, can you please tell me how you're defining addiction? Because I have heard that word a thousand times this show, and I don't know what you mean by it.
Sure. So I can repeat the definition the way that I see it. It is a chronically relapsing brain disorder that has to do with repeated self-drug administration despite severe consequences, harmful consequences to an individual's life, their cherished goals in their life, their family, their job, everything they like. So despite those severe consequences and despite a reduction in the pleasure that is derived from drugs, and still there is that compulsive drug use, that chronic type of drug use in those individuals. So you have the combination of loss of control over drug use despite severe consequences and despite decreasing the pleasure. That's, in my mind, what defines addiction and what separates it from many, many related concepts such as bad habits that we all have, such as drug abuse, so even the occasional binging, and such as even dependence. So people can get dependent on morphine, on other painkillers, and only a minority develop addiction. Although I have to, of course, mention the opiate epidemic that we're going through. And that is a very dangerous one. 33,000 people died just the last year from overdoses from opiates. But most people who are exposed to those type of, most people with dependence to drugs that to reduce pain actually do not develop addiction.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rita Z. Goldstein of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is chief of neuropsychoimaging of addiction and related conditions. If you would like to join our conversation, call 800-933-5372. Rita, is it reasonable to assume that our brains evolved before addictive substances existed?
Before some of them, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you know, the story that comes to my mind about that would be the one where elephants love alcohol.
Yeah, they find fermented fruit and
yeah, they actually they help in the fermentation process. They stomp on it and they have those. I don't know how frequently that happens, but it does happen. So not only humans enjoy the pleasures of some drugs of abuse. But in terms of brain development and, you know, in utero, prenatally, hopefully most of us are not exposed to drugs, although we are exposed to many different types of substances.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have JR calling from Grapevine. Hi, JR.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question pertains to alcohol and alcoholism. The 12-step programs generally teach that that person is in the grips of a progressive illness that can never get better. And I'm curious if Ms. Goldstein has any insight as to how the brain repairs itself as she's seen it and whether that statement is true, that the alcoholic can never drink again. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
In animal models, for example, it has been shown that any type of learning process has an immediate effect on brain volume and so the actual morphological integrity of the brain, the connectivity between brain regions. And you can see that type of effect immediately after learning, even within one day of learning, and then it lasts for a long time. It has to do with synaptic type of integrity, with releases of neurotransmitters. So the brain, our brain is constantly learning and shaping itself. So there is always a hope for change, and there is always change. So although many people reach, and drug addiction, I mentioned, it is a lethal disorder. Some people reach the stages, end stages of the disease, where there is really, where the associated consequences are catastrophic. But I think that because of our brain plasticity, and when we always are revealing another marker and another type of measure that shows how the brain can change, even when we are very, very old. So I think that the hope should always be there. And beyond hope, there has to be an intervention. And this is where our studies are leading us now, beyond how can we use those neuroimaging studies, how can we use everything that we learned up to today in terms of those gray matter and all the measures that we use in terms of the imaging, what can we do now to intervene? And this is, I think, is a core question. And we have to intervene. And it's not that the intervention has to be either or. So either pharmacological with medication or behavioral type of interventions or just a 12-step program. No, because everybody is very different and we do have to find what is it that works the best for that person. There are many things that we can do, but we have to do them. We have to apply them. We have to stop resisting identifying addiction as a brain disorder, because when we do resist that, we cannot use whatever we have developed to intervene, like with other disorders, for example, bipolar disorder.
My guest is Rita Z. Goldstein, Chief of Neuropsychoimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions Research Program. That's at the Icahn School of Medicine. Her work is featured in National Geographic next month in a piece called How Science is Unlocking the Secrets of Addiction. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd here with Rita Z. Goldstein of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, where she is Chief of Neuropsychoimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Rita, we've had anti-drug programs for kids for a long time. We know that things like DARE that just say don't do it don't work all that well over time. Programs that really educate kids about what drugs are and how they work seem to work a bit better. I wonder if there's something else, a brain-related approach that parents and teachers might take before the age at which kids might be exposed to addictive substances. I mean, is there some way that we might be able to help young people build up the parts of their brains that would allow them to resist drug cues in the first place?
It's a wonderful question. And I have to mention the ABCD study. It's NIH-funded, mostly NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse. The acronym stands for Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study. And across 20, over 20 institutes, more than 11,000 children at the age of 9 to 10-year-old will be scanned at baseline, which is mostly pre-drug use. And then this cohort of kids will be re-scanned again and again every basically 2 years. But it has to do actually with prediction of just general outcomes and well-being. So if we can increase the well-being of our children and their cognitive function, their emotional function, if we can identify any type of difficulties kids have and treat those, any type of ADHD symptoms, any type of OCD was mentioned here before. So I think that right now the important thing is to increase our own awareness as parents, as educators, to emotional difficulties that kids may have, and then target those and enhance children's well-being, and that will be protective later on.
We have an email from Steve who writes, if I'm understanding correctly, the mere sight of a package of cigarettes keeps my brain from recovering. I have quit smoking, however, my roommate has not. Does seeing his cigarettes in the house perpetuate my cravings?
For many people, those type of drug-related cues definitely enhance craving, absolutely. And but some people have developed ability to cope with craving, although craving is a very negative, strong emotional type of state where it puts you on the go. But you cannot, basically, where the ability to resist then goal-driven behavior, such as, for example, taking a cigarette, is very hard. So if I could have made any recommendations for a person who is trying to abstain from smoking, yes, is to decrease exposure to those type of stimuli that increase craving. Absolutely.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Wes calling from Dallas. Hello, Wes.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
I was calling to ask what the implications of the research would be on treatment options for people who are coping with addiction. Are you working directly with any treatment providers, and what do you see the implications of your research to be to have more effective therapy for people who are trying to quit?
That's a great question. In my lab, we do work with treatment providers. We work with larger and smaller ones. I'll mention Samaritan Village, Phoenix House in the New York area. Right now, we're studying the phenomena of incubation of craving, where animal studies have shown that with abstinence, before craving measures decrease like you would expect, they actually increase. So a person who's trying to abstain from drugs, they actually are dealing with craving that is gradually increasing, reaching a peak at 6 months after abstinence. And this is a time where most people have already been discharged from treatment, and we are discharging them prematurely when peak craving is happening before it then decreases. So once we study this type of effect longitudinally, we can then identify for every individual where is it their peak vulnerability time. And this is what needs to be targeted for then interventions. And there are many type of interventions that are out there already, pharmacological ones with naltrexone, buprenorphine, other type of drugs. In my lab, we are developing behavioral type of interventions to decrease salience of drug use, to enhance self-control, and to do all of this under the effects of drugs such as, for example, methylphenidate, which is Ritalin, what we give kids with ADHD, because it blocks the dopamine transporters and it enhances salience of stimuli. And we think that using this type of combined approach, the pharmacological with the behavioral approach, so we retrain the brain, we are making it relearn some patterns during effects of a drug that can enhance the saliency of this learning. And we think that eventually will enhance the ability of an individual to regain self-control and to not use drugs or to an excess.
When people who are addicted to a drug are like between uses and they're sober, how do they describe the way they experience cravings to use that drug?
Some people would say it's like a demon inside of them. People describe craving as an intense negative pull. Really, it's like pulling you against your best intentions, best wishes, to do something you really, really don't want to do.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Clint calling from Dallas. Hey, Clint.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
So basically my question was just, how is the recovery process different for basically based on the time that the onset of addiction happened for the individual? So, for example, someone who became addicted at an age of like 20 versus someone who became addicted in their later years, maybe 40 or 50.
Yeah, so age of onset is clearly crucial to understanding addiction. Most of the time, the younger the age of onset, the more severe the addiction and the harder it is to stop. And not to say that people with very young onset do not manage to stop, and some people clearly do. But it is a more severe type of phenotype.
All right, let's go next to Mike in the Colony. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Chris. Great show as always.
Thank you.
I was wondering if your guest could comment just a little bit on some of the recent headlines, at least on social media that I've seen, about the use of other psychoactive substances in the treatment of addiction and depression. Specifically, I've seen things about MDMA, LSD, ketamine, magic mushrooms, sort of having, you know, just remarkable effects in the treatments of addiction and depression. And I was curious if there have been any, you know, brain studies that back that sort of thing up, or if she knows anything about it.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I find them very exciting, this actual studies, because we are trying to think out of the box. Addiction is a treatment-resistant disorder. It's a chronically relapsing. It's lethal. So we need to definitely think outside the box. And we know what are the brain substrates underlying addiction. So this type of, for example, I'll mention replacement therapy that works quite well. So using methadone instead of heroin. So that's something that is working and saves people's life. You have other type of drugs, buprenorphine, naltrexone that I mentioned. And I also mentioned methylphenidate or Ritalin that can work with stimulant addiction. And in our lab, I'm not going to mention the other drugs because we did not study them yet, especially with imaging. But in our lab, we did study the use of methylphenidate in combination with salient tasks. And in a series of studies, we did show normalization of brain function in cocaine-addicted individuals. So when they perform salient type of reward processing tasks or self-inhibitory type of task, or even at a resting state where we see abnormalities in the way brain regions interact and communicate with each other, even at that level, when we give methylphenidate, we can see normalization of those type of crosstalk and the function of brain regions in people with crack cocaine addiction.
You're listening.
So it is replacement therapy. I'm talking about replacement therapy, basically.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rita, the National Geographic article that features your work also reports on research being done in Italy that uses electromagnetic waves to treat addicted brains. I know this is not your lab, but I wonder if that's research that you've been paying attention to.
Yes, very much so, absolutely. And that the article mentioned TMS, so transcranial magnetic stimulation. There is also efforts at TDCS, transcranial direct current stimulation, which is a different technology entirely. But the concept there for both of them is, okay, let's target specific brain regions as much as we can from the surface. So there is nothing invasive, it's not a surgery. But let's try to normalize those brain functions by targeting them either magnetically or electrically. And let's basically try to get them to work in a way that can be beneficial. There is also DBS, and deep brain stimulation, that is being used with Parkinson's disease, OCD, and not as much with addiction yet. But it's something that we are thinking about.
Are those treatments, do they come with additional side effects if they affect the, you know, the reward, the way that the brain processes stimuli and a desire for an addictive substance? Do they also interfere with the way we, you know, pursue an income and our next meal?
Every intervention has its side effects, has its strengths and weaknesses, and not everything will be good for everybody. So with methylphenidate, we cannot give it to people with certain medical conditions. With TMS, there is a risk for induction of a seizure. So we have to do it the right way, and we have to pre-select people for the right interventions for them. And we are trying to design interventions that will decrease craving for drugs without affecting behaviors and responses to other non-drug related rewards and stimuli in the environment. And that's actually the whole beauty of contrasting drug related stimuli with non-drug related rewards. And we definitely want to zoom in on that normalization and recovery of a response to a non-drug related reward. So when you are addicted, the response to things that are rewarding, naturally rewarding, is very much dampened. And there is that, and zooming in on the drug-related cues as one, and drugs themselves as a channel through which all your reward is coming through. Actually, everything else is very gray, is very reduced. So, if anything, we're trying to flip that equation.
All right, let's go very quickly here to Tanya in Fort Worth. Hey, Tanya.
Hi. I was just wondering if there'd been any brain studies on what made one person choose a certain substance of abuse and not another, because I have known people that were on morphine for medical reasons, but were, you know, I guess addicts to other substances, but they got off morphine and had no problem and tapered off, and they'd been on it for 15 years and went through withdrawal and had no desire to use morphine again, but yet they continued to abuse the other substance.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have an answer for that, because the type of studies we do and the complexity of human behavior, so a person can be addicted to one substance and have no problem at all with another substance. There are people who smoke crack cocaine and don't smoke cigarettes. Other people, although 75%, about 75%, both smoke crack cocaine and cigarettes. But the other 25% don't. And there are people who don't drink alcohol. So they smoke crack cocaine, but do not drink alcohol. So being addicted to one drug doesn't mean you will be addicted to another. Being ability to abstain from one doesn't mean you will be able to abstain from them all. I think if we help people at least reduce their drug use and at least have some sort of control so that the consequences are not as catastrophic, that's already a benefit. That's already an achievement. If we can enhance their ability to make the right decision at the right time, it's something to celebrate.
Rita Z. Goldstein is chief of the Neuropsychoimaging of Addiction and Related Conditions Research Program, or NARC, at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Her work is featured in the September issue of National Geographic magazine in a piece called How Science is Unlocking the Secrets of Addiction. Rita, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Eric Bright is technical director today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast and learn about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.